3149, Joe versus Wyatt. Yes, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Andy Vickery. I'm a lawyer from Houston, Texas, and I need to start with an apology to the court. If you've ever found yourself in the wrong place at the right time, you know how mortified I was to be sitting up on the 27th floor in the other courtroom.
Well, Mr. Vickery, I'm at the wrong place at the right time, so there are two of us. In the same position. You just go ahead and...
Thank you, Judge Roebner. I don't know that I will even take all of the time this morning, although it's an intriguing case and I could talk about it for a long time. I represent a very nice lady named Jackie Giles, and she is a Southern Illinois coal miner's widow. She's a widow, I believe, because the medication that her husband was given in the fall of 2002, Effexor, did not have the warnings that it should have had then and that it has now. The first issue in this appeal is one of first impression in this circuit. There are cases we've cited from the 10th and the 5th, although there's no real good discussion of them. There's just sort of snippets in those opinions. But the question is whether or not a warning that is issued by a pharmaceutical company at the behest of the FDA rather than voluntarily is a post-remedial measure within the meaning of Rule 407. Now, it's clear from the comments to the rules that the rule is designed to encourage companies to do the kind of voluntary warning that Wyeth, in fact, did in August of 2003 with regard to pediatric suicidality. They looked at their data. They said, oh, boy, we may be in trouble. We better warn people. We're going to issue a letter. They issued a letter signed by Dr. Joe Camardo, their chief witness at trial, that said, hey, docs, this drug is not approved for kids, and there's a risk of suicide. You need to be aware of that. Well, beginning the following year, in 04 and 05 and again in 07, there's a whole series of increasingly more stringent warnings about the risk of suicide for, quote, all patients or patients of all ages. And those are really laid out in sequence in our reply brief. I submit to you that it is contrary to the purposes of Rule 407 to give them the protection of having a post-remedial measure and to exclude it as if they chose to do it. And this does distinguish your opinion, Judge Roebner, last year in Schlopek, you know, the polar cat case. You did say that the motive is irrelevant, but it was very clear that that was done by the medical device company at its own behest.
That was a voluntary subsequent measure, not a government-mandated one.
Well, this is very clear. The record is very clear that the 04, 05, and 07 warnings, which are now in black boxes for patients, quote, of all ages, were done at the behest and the insistence of the FDA, not because Wyeth were being good guys.
Now, but here's what I need help with. Even if we were to determine that the subsequent remedial measure of the new warning label could be introduced, I'm not sure how that would help Giles. In other words, what Giles wanted to introduce was evidence of the 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007 warnings. If the FDA and Wyeth figured out in 2003 that suicide was a potential risk with this medication, how would it help when the tragic event that precipitated this case occurred in 2002?
Because, Judge Roebner, the reclassification that was done in late 06 that resulted in the 07 warning was the kind of analysis of the pre-existing database. In other words, they weren't looking at new data that just came in. They were reclassifying and reanalyzing data that had been along for a long time in the clinical trial database of effects at Wyeth.
But prior to 2002, it seems there was no good data that indicated the depressed adults on the antidepressants were more prone to suicide than depressed adults, not on antidepressant. And it appears that there isn't any good data showing that adults are more suicidal when on antidepressants even now.
Not true, Your Honor. The data was there all along. The data that resulted in the 07 warning was data that existed long before my client's husband took this drug. It's just that Wyeth had not done what the FDA finally did for them in 06, which was to analyze that data in a meaningful way, which would demonstrate the relationship, the association between this drug and suicide. The FDA finally did it for them in 06, and that resulted in a black box warning. My point is, if they had done it themselves, I mean, their clinical trial data, way back when the drug was approved in 93, shows the risk of suicide, both completed suicides and suicide attempts, on Effexor was double that, which is important, of course, under Daubert too.
But weren't the warnings addressed to the dangers of suicide in patients under 24 years old? So
the warning as it exists now in 07, and we've really laid it out in the reply brief, but the warning says that the causal relationship is established up through age 24, but it goes on to say that patients of all ages must be very carefully monitored for development of suicidal thinking and the precursors to it, particularly when they start the drug, which is very, very important. That same FDA memorandum that Judge Gilbert excluded from evidence says, yes, at 65 and older, this drug may reduce suicidality. On the other hand, in that document, if I could have gotten it into evidence, I could have cross-examined their witnesses and showed the jury, it says if you just look at the first month with elderly patients, 65 and older, there's a fivefold risk of a violent suicide. And so it changes over time. There's something in the current warnings for everyone. My point is, when they issue those warnings at the behest of the government instead of voluntarily, then they are not entitled to the protections of Rule 407. And in fact, it runs contrary to what Rule 407 is designed to do, to exclude it. Now that gets compounded enormously. Standing in isolation, I think that would be error. It's an error of law because it's interpretation of Rule 407. It's reviewed de novo by this court. But that gets enormously compounded when the court then allows Wyeth to put witnesses on the stand and talk about all of this 06 data, and even to give a highly speculative opinion. Dr. Camardo, the same guy that wrote the August 03 Dear Doctor letter warning about suicide in pediatric patients, my friend Mr. Herman, who I was just looking for in the on the 27th floor, did a wonderful job with that witness of saying, well, gee, do you think the FDA would have let you guys warn if you wanted to back in 02? Oh, no, I don't. Over my objection. No, I don't think they would have allowed us to do that. And I needed to cross-examine that man and say, good gracious, they made you do it. They made you do it in 04 and 05, and they're making you do it this year in a black box that says patients of all ages need to be examined carefully. So I was really... And I don't mean in any way to impugn Judge Gilbert. He is a wonderful man and was very courteous to a bunch of old Texas lawyers on both sides. But it was like the judge tied my hands behind my back, and then Mr. Herman did a masterful job of whipping up on me in front of the jury with a witness I could not cross-examine or impeach based on warnings that his own client had issued, one of which this man had signed. That's the meat and potatoes of it, and if the court has no further questions, I'll save my other time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
We'll save that for dessert.
Thank you, Mr. Victor Vickery.
Thank you.
Okay. Is it Mr. Herman that's there?
It is, Your Honor. I'm Mark Herman for the appellee, Wyeth. The trial court excluded the subsequent labeling on two different grounds. On Federal Rule of Evidence 403, because it would have been more prejudicial than probative, and also under 407 as a subsequent remedial measure. Mr. Vickery, not surprisingly, chooses to talk about Rule 407 because he can characterize that as a question of first impression and an interesting question of law for this court. If he were to talk about 403, the other ground that the judge also excluded this on, he would be forced to concede that it is an abuse of discretion standard of review and that Judge Gilbert was hardly out of line weighing the minimal probative value of this against the likelihood of undue prejudice or undue waste of time and deciding as a matter of his discretion that he would exclude that evidence.
So Mr. Herman, there's a question that really dogged me throughout the brief. And that is why Wyeth wanted to keep the later warnings out of evidence, because they seem to help you by demonstrating the protective or neutral effect on patients over 24 years of age. And you stated as much in your brief at page 34. And what I'm trying to understand is why you weren't pushing to let this evidence in rather than to keep it out.
Your Honor, but for the attorney-client privilege, I'd love to regale you with the stories of the internal discussions that we had on that before trial. But ultimately, Wyeth's decision was that if it came into evidence, we were sure to hear at a it wasn't like the FDA said on a certain date in 2005 or 2006, presto, now is the label. Instead, it was going to be leading the jury through a five-year meandering regulatory path. There was a health advisory, there was an advisory committee, there was a new warning that talked about pediatric, there were more health advisories and another advisory committee, and then they extended it to adults under age 25, and we were going to be talking a whole lot at trial about some suspected evidence of suicidality for people who were 20 years and young and more younger than Mr. Giles, and that spending all of that trial time talking about a different age class could just be prejudicial. So we preferred to talk about the scientific evidence, but not to have to waste time with this five-year meandering regulatory history that ultimately resulted in perhaps there's a risk of suicidality in people 25 and under, but there is no risk of suicidality and perhaps even a protective effect for adults who are 25 and older. Now, you have two things really wrapped up in there, both of which Judge Gilbert could appropriately think about. One is the prejudice, because we knew full well the plaintiff wanted to argue, well, if there's a chance it causes suicidality in teenagers, couldn't it also cause suicidality in adults? So that was the prejudice that we wanted to avoid. And there was also an undue waste of time, which is we were going to have to walk through these 5 years of advisory committees and health advisories, and not just one later warning, but iteration after iteration of later warnings. So on balance, we didn't want it in. And on balance, Judge Gilbert agreed as a matter of his discretion.
Did you ever make an objection to the evidence on these later warnings just on relevance grounds?
Well, when you're talking
great relevance, I mean, I know that's part of what's in the 403 analysis.
That was the way that it came out. We did not independently say it's irrelevant, but we said it is of marginal relevance because it speaks to different age classes and on balance weighed against the prejudice and the waste of time. It isn't worth admitting. Now that's a discretionary decision. The judge hardly just walked out of the asylum when he thought about the sorts of things that we are just talking about and says, on balance, I'm going to keep that out. Under an abuse of discretion standard of review, that is entirely appropriate, which is why, of course, Mr. Vickery chooses not to mention Rule 403 and only to talk about 407. Now, he might say, how do you know the judge ruled based on 403? And the answer to that is, the judge said so. At page 1309 of the trial transcript, the judge says, under 403, my ruling is the same. I'm excluding it because it's more prejudicial than probative. So he runs into a different ground for the ruling that simply leaves the plaintiff speechless. There is no reason for this court even to think about the 407 subsequent remedial measures point, because 403 is ample ground for excluding the evidence. But if the court were to decide to reach the 407 point, Judge Gilbert was correct there too. The plaintiff concedes, as she must, that by its terms, Rule 407 excludes the subsequent labeling. That is, the rule says later evidence, subsequent remedial measures offered to prove culpability or inadequacy of a warning are inadmissible, period. It doesn't say the subsequent remedial measures, if offered to prove culpability or an inadequate warning, are inadmissible, subject, of course, to the government-mandated mandated changes exception, which is an exception to the words that we just wrote. That is, the language of 407, the plain language of the rule, says the subsequent remedial measures must be excluded.
Voluntary or ordered?
The rule simply says subsequent remedial measures offered to prove culpability or inadequacy of warnings are inadmissible. If offered for other purposes, such as feasibility, they might be admitted. But it doesn't say a word about government mandated or not. So the plain text of the rule doesn't admit of the exception.
There's a word that was kicked around that I'm not that familiar with, but this a cathesia. The reaction.
Oh, akathisia, yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't know the pronunciation.
You're the same situation I was in 3 years ago.
Okay, well.
Akathisia.
Okay, because I guess this Dr. Ticknor, he said something rather imposing where he's saying, based on Mr. Giles' demeanor and what went on for the 2 days or so that after he took this drug, he was quiet and sedate and whatever, which is exactly contrary to that. Whatever that disease is or whatever that reaction is. Now, that that went to the jury, I presume.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, look, the jury only had to be 6 people. We had 12. In a civil case, we only needed 9 out of 12 to win. We got unanimous all 12. The case was tried for 3 weeks. It was 3 hours of deliberation for a jury of 12 to unanimously come to a defense verdict. This was not a hard case for the jury, and presumably not hard because, first of all, we had a perfectly good learned intermediary defense. Second of all, you had this FDA study and a ton of other data saying that in adults over age 25, there's no relationship between the antidepressants and suicide. And then thirdly, the mechanism of action that the plaintiff said, which was that you take the pill and you become intensely jittery. You can't sit still. And therefore, to put yourself out of your misery, you spontaneously decide to kill yourself. This was a man who takes the pills for 36 hours. After he takes the first pill, he watches television for a couple of hours. Then the next morning, he sits quietly with his mother for a couple of hours. Then he watches television for 2 hours the next afternoon and for 3 hours after dinner the next night. And then the morning after goes out and commits suicide. So it was not an intensely jittery, couldn't sit still sort of situation. Even if you accepted the plaintiff's mechanism of action, they had no evidence of it. The other evidence point that Mr. Vickery talks about before you is the scientific evidence about adult suicide. And, of course, the scientific evidence about adult suicide comes – nobody did, and nobody would possibly have said in a case that raises the question, do antidepressants cause adults to commit suicide, you should exclude some or all of the evidence about whether antidepressants – cause adults to commit suicide, right? I mean, the question of causation had to be decided, and the only way to look at the causation question is to admit the available scientific evidence. We had a big spat about the labeling. Does the subsequent labeling come in? Because as for the adequacy of the warning, you have to look at what Wyeth knew or should have known as of October 2002. You stop the clock as of October 2002 because that's the knowledge that matters. But as for could the drug cause somebody to commit suicide? All of that evidence comes in. Wyeth never moved to exclude the evidence on adult suicidality. The plaintiff never moved to exclude the evidence on adult suicidality. There was never an objection to that. What the plaintiff wants you to believe was an objection to it is when we were arguing the subsequent remedial measures, Mr. Vickery stood up and said, I don't understand how this will work. All of the evidence, the science about the adult suicide is going to come into evidence. If all of the science is coming into evidence, don't you also have to admit the labeling, the later labeling that was based on the science? And the judge didn't accept that argument and excluded the subsequent remedial measures. But that was not an objection to the science. That was an assumption that the science was going to come in, because if you're going to try a case about whether or not antidepressants cause people to commit suicide, you need the evidence on causality to come in. This case is driven by the standard of review. They are looking at two evidentiary questions. First, under Rule 403, was it an abuse of discretion for the judge to decide that the later labeling was potentially more prejudicial and an undue waste of time than it was probative? Plainly, it was not an abuse of discretion to do that. Only if the court gets beyond that abuse of discretion standard of review does it even have to think about the 407 issue. And on the 407 issue, you have the text of the rule, you have the Klopek case suggesting that motive doesn't matter, you have cases in other circuits such as Werner in the Fourth and Stahl in the Fifth and Deluria in the Eighth, all saying that later FDA warnings come in. And then finally, you have the question of the adult suicide data. There was no objection to whether or not the adult suicide data should come in. And obviously, it has to be admissible because it's the only way you can decide a suicide case. Standard review drives this appeal. This court should affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. How much time does Mr. Vickery have?
5 minutes.
Okay, Mr. Vickery.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are several things I'd like to follow up on.
Sure.
I do agree that the case is largely driven by the standard of review. It was very clear. I mean, we argued motions in limine for the better part of 2 days. So when we argued the issue of subsequent remedial measures, we were arguing Rule 407, and Judge Gilbert's in limine ruling was based on Rule 407, as the transcript clearly reflects. That kept me in my case in chief from putting in evidence with my experts, putting in documentary evidence of what the post-remedial warnings were. It is certainly true that at one point in the trial, and at one point only, when I was cross-examining Dr. Camardo, that the judge said, my ruling will be the same, and he did mention Rule 403. However, I don't think that if his ruling is the same, and it was clearly based on lengthy pretrial hearings where he was following Rule 407, in fact, he even said more than that. He said, it'll be the same. I haven't let in subsequent remedial measures before, and I'm not going to start with this case. I don't think it's incumbent on me to say, excuse me, Your Honor, now are you changing the basis of your ruling with regard to this point in time and this witness? I think, Judge Rogan, you asked a good question.
So let me just go back for a minute. So you didn't feel that you could even pose that to Judge Gilbert even during a recess or something if there was some problem with the 403 analysis?
I didn't think I needed to because we had debated it, the whole issue at length, and we had debated the fairness of it. I mean, as you can tell, I'm fairly plain spoken, and in the pretrial I said, Judge, they're going to let the cat out of the bag if they're going to go into the data. Mr. Herman does a wonderful job of trying to say, well, this is the scientific evidence, this is a labeling, and it's like they're two different things. It's the FDA's analysis of it that leads the FDA to conclusions that people need to be warned.
Right. No, the only reason my question was prompted was because you sort of suggested, not quite understanding the basis of 403 or you didn't want to raise it with the court, and I know Judge Gilbert is the kind of judge that would further explain a ruling if there was any.
He's a wonderful judge, and he would have, but I thought it was abundantly clear from the pretrial, which was 2 days, that this is a 407 decision in his mind, and he's not going to do it. Now, 403 is always a catch-all, and you can throw it in there. Of course, Judge Mannion's opinion in Palmquist, I think, addresses when that's reversible error and when it's not. Just because you magically say 403, which throws us into an abuse of discretion standard, still doesn't mean that it's not reversible error. I submit to you that when you have a drug that now has a black box warning for patients of all ages, specifically focused at this period of time when you're first starting the drug, and when you have not only the akathisia but the emotional blunting, Your Honor, as two different biologically plausible mechanisms explained in the evidence, that it's a travesty of justice to try this case and result in a verdict where the jury doesn't get all the information. Now, every one of us in every court sees every witness say, I'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The jury did not hear the whole truth, and they didn't hear it because our hands were tied by the court's ruling that we could not bring out the whole truth. And I suspect if truth be known, of course, I'm not privy to the privileged conversations between Mr. Sear and Mr. Herman, but I suspect if truth be known, they didn't want the warning in evidence because the prescribing doctor normally prescribed a different medication. And he testified very strongly, I heed warnings, particularly those in black boxes, and I paid attention to them, and if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have prescribed this drug at all. So there is a ton of reason why this, the exclusion of this evidence in this case results in a serious miscarriage of justice. If there are no other questions, I think that's all I have to offer.
Well, I thank you both very much. Thank you, Mr. Vickery, and thank you, Mr. Herman, and the case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And we